Tired of chasing the latest weight loss trends? It's time to cut through the noise and discover a sustainable solution with Robody. Say goodbye to extremes and hello to real, lasting results. Having personally navigated my recent weight loss journey through willpower, calorie counting, and probably too much caffeine, I know the struggle. If I were eligible for Robody today, I wouldn't hesitate to embrace a scientifically backed approach to achieve my goals. Ro provides access to the most popular weight loss shots on the market. The Robody program pairs a weekly shot with healthy lifestyle changes, so you can lose 15 to 20% of your weight in a year on average and actually keep it off. Say goodbye to the roller coaster of weight loss and hello to sustainable results with Robody. Go to ro.co/snoozecast. Sign up today and you'll pay just $99 for your first month and $145 a month after that. Medication costs are separate. That's ro.co/snoozecast.
Snoozecast, the podcast designed to help you fall asleep. Find us at snoozecast.com, and if you enjoy our show, please share us with a friend. This episode is brought to you by A Flight of Sea Swallows. Tonight, we'll read the next part to 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, a classic science fiction adventure novel by French writer Jules Verne. In the last episode, it's the new year, and Aronnax keeps himself busy studying on the submarine as usual. The Nautilus enters dangerous waters and gets stuck on a reef. Seeing as they're already stuck on land, Ned and Conseil convince Aronnax to ask Nemo to let them go ashore to explore, hunt, and reconnect with solid ground. Get cozy. Close your eyes. Relax your body into the softness of your bed. Now, take a few deep breaths. Great surprise. Captain Nemo gave me the permission I asked for, and he gave it very agreeably, without even exacting from me a promise to return to the vessel. But flight across New Guinea might be very perilous, and I should not have counseled Ned Land to attempt it. Better to be a prisoner on board the Nautilus than to risk it. At 8 o'clock, armed with guns and hatchets, we got off the Nautilus. The sea was pretty calm. A slight breeze blew on land. Conseil and I were rowing. We sped along quickly, and Ned steered in the straight passage that the breakers left between them. The boat was well handled and moved rapidly. Ned Land could not restrain his joy. He was like a prisoner that had escaped from prison and knew not that it was necessary to re-enter it. I said, "I do not say that fish is not good. We must not abuse it. But a piece of fresh venison grilled on live coals will agreeably vary our ordinary course." "Glutton," said Conseil. "He makes my mouth water." remains to be seen, I said, if these forests are full of game, and if the game is not such as will hunt the hunter himself. Well said, Monsieur Aronnax, replied the Canadian, whose teeth seemed sharpened like the edge of a hatchet. But I will eat a tiger, loin of tiger, if there is no other quadruped on this island. Friend Ned is uneasy about it, said Conseil. Whatever it may be, continued Ned Land, every animal with four paws without feathers, or with two paws without feathers, will be saluted by my first shot. Very well. Master Land's imprudences are beginning. Never fear, Monsieur Aronnax, replied the Canadian. I do not want 25 minutes to offer you a dish of my sort. At 8:30, the Nautilus boat ran softly aground on a heavy sand, after having happily passed the coral reef that surrounds the island of Gilboa. Chapter 20. A Few Days on Land. I was much impressed on touching land. Ned Land tried the soil with his feet, as if to take possession of it. However, it was only 2 months before that we had become, according to Captain Nemo, passengers on board the Nautilus, but in reality, prisoners of its commander. In a few minutes, we were within musket shot of the coast. The whole horizon was hidden behind a beautiful curtain of forests, enormous trees, the trunks of which attained a height of 200 feet, were tied to each other by garlands of birdweed, real natural hammocks, which a light breeze rocked. They were mimosas, figs, hibiscus, and palm trees, mingled together in profusion, and under the shelter of their verdant vault grew orchards, plants, and ferns. But without noticing all these beautiful specimens of Papuan flora, the Canadian abandoned the agreeable for the useful. He discovered a cocoa tree, beat down some of the fruit, broke them, and we drank the milk and ate the nut with a satisfaction that protested against the ordinary food on the Nautilus. Excellent, said Ned Land. Exquisite, replied Conseil. And I do not think, said the Canadian, that he would object to our introducing a cargo of coconuts on board. I do not think he would, but he would not taste them. So much the worse for him, said Conseil. And so much the better for us, replied Ned Land. There will be more for us. One word only, Master Land, I said to the harpooner, who was beginning to ravage another coconut tree. Coconuts are good things, but before filling the canoe with them, it would be wise to reconnoiter and see if the island does not produce some substance not less useful. Fresh vegetables would be welcome on board the Nautilus. Master is right, replied Conseil, and I propose to reserve 3 places in our vessel, one for fruits, the other for vegetables, and the third for venison, of which I have not yet seen the smallest specimen. Conseil, we must not despair, said the Canadian. Let us continue, I returned, and lie in wait. Although the island seems uninhabited, it might still contain some individuals that would be less hard than we on the nature of game. While we were talking thus, we were penetrating the somber arches of the forest, and for 2 hours we surveyed it in all directions. Chance rewarded our search for eatable vegetables, and one of the most useful products of the tropical zones furnished us with precious food that we missed on board. I would speak of the breadfruit tree, very abundant in the island of Gilboa, and I remarked chiefly the variety destitute of seeds, which bears in Malaya the name of Rima. Ned Land knew these fruits well. He had already eaten many during his numerous voyages, and he knew how to prepare the eatable substance. Moreover, the sight of them excited him, and he could contain himself no longer. "I shall die if I do not taste a little of this breadfruit pie." "Taste it, friend Ned. Taste it as you want. We are here to make experiments. Make them." "It won't take long," said the Canadian. And provided with a lentil, he lighted a fire of dead wood that crackled joyously. During this time, Conseil and I chose the best fruits of the breadfruit. Some had not then attained a sufficient degree of maturity, and their thick skin covered a white, but rather fibrous pulp. Others, the greater number yellow and gelatinous, waited only to be picked. These fruits enclosed no kernel. Conseil brought a dozen to Ned Land, who placed them on a coal fire, after having cut them in thick slices, and while doing this, repeating, "You'll see. You'll see how good this bread is. More so when one has been deprived of it so long. It is not even bread," added he, "but a delicate pastry." "You have eaten none?" "No, Ned." "Very well. Prepare yourself for a juicy thing. If you do not come for more, I am no longer the king of harpooners." After some minutes, the part of the fruits that was exposed to the fire was completely roasted. The interior looked like a white pastry, a sort of soft crumb, the flavor of which was like that of an artichoke. It must be confessed, this bread was excellent, and I ate of it with great relish. "What time is it now?" asked the Canadian. 2 o'clock at least," replied Conseil. "How time flies on firm ground," sighed Ned Land. "Let us be off," replied Conseil. We returned through the forest and completed our collection by a raid upon the cabbage palms that we gathered from the tops of the trees, little beans that I recognized as the abro of the Malays and yams of a superior quality. We were loaded when we reached the boat, but Ned Land did not find his provisions sufficient. Fate, however, favored us. Just as we were pushing off, he perceived several trees from 25 to 30 feet high, a species of palm tree. At last, at 5 o'clock in the evening, loaded with our riches, we quitted the shore, and half an hour after, we hailed the Nautilus. No one appeared on our arrival. The enormous iron-plated cylinder seemed deserted. The provisions embarked. I descended to my chamber, and after supper slept soundly. The next day, 6th of January, nothing new on board. Not a sound inside, not a sign of life. the boat rested along the edge, in the same place in which we had left it. We resolved to return to the island. Ned Land hoped to be more fortunate than on the day before with regard to the hunt, and wished to visit another part of the forest. At dawn, we set off. The boat, carried on by the waves that flowed to shore, reached the island in a few minutes. We landed, and thinking that it was better to give in to the Canadian, we followed Ned Land, whose long limbs threatened to distance us. He wound up the coast towards the west, then, fording some torrents, he gained the high plain that was bordered with admirable forests. Some kingfishers were rambling along the watercourses, but they would not let themselves be approached. Their circumspection proved to me that these birds knew what to expect from bipeds of our species, and I concluded that, if the island was not inhabited, at least human beings occasionally frequented it. After crossing a rather large prairie, we arrived at the skirts of a little wood that was enlivened by the songs and flight of a large number of birds. "There are only birds," said Conseil. Indeed, under the thick foliage of this wood, a world of parrots were flying from branch to branch, only needing a careful education to speak the human language. For the moment, they were chattering with parrots of all colors and grave cockatoos who seemed to meditate upon some philosophical problem, whilst brilliant red lories passed like a piece of bunting carried away by the breeze. Papuans with the finest azure colors and in all variety of winged things, most charming to behold, but few eatable. However, a bird peculiar to these lands, and which has never passed the limits of the Arrow Islands, was wanting in this collection, but fortune reserved it for me before long. After passing through a moderately thick copse, we found a plain obstructed with bushes. I saw then those magnificent birds, the disposition of whose long feathers obliges them to fly against the wind, their undulating flight, graceful aerial curves, and the shading of their colors attracted and charmed one's looks. I had no trouble in recognizing them. "Birds of paradise," I exclaimed. About 11 o'clock in the morning, the first range of mountains that form the center of the island was traversed. Hunger drove us on. The hunters had relied on the products of the chase, and they were wrong. Happy Conseil, to his great surprise, secured breakfast. He brought down a white pigeon and a wood pigeon, which was roasted before a red fire of wood. While these interesting birds were cooking, Ned prepared the fruit of the bread tree. Then we ate, and it was excellent. The nutmeg, with which they are in the habit of stuffing their crops, renders it delicious eating. "Now, Ned, what do you miss now?" "Some four-footed game, Monsieur Aronnax. These pigeons are only trifles." "Let us go towards the sea," replied Conseil. "We have arrived at the first declivities of the mountains, and I think we had better regain the region of forests." That was sensible advice, and was followed out. After walking for 1 hour, we had attained a forest of sago trees. Some inoffensive serpents glided away from us. The birds of paradise fled at our approach, and truly, I despaired of getting near one with Conseil, who was walking in front, suddenly bent down, uttered a triumphal cry, and came back to me, bringing a magnificent specimen. Ah, bravo, Conseil. It's very good. No, you have made an excellent stroke. Take one of these living birds and carry it in your hand. If you'll examine it, you'll see that I have not deserved great merit. Why, Conseil? Because this bird is as drunk as a quail. Drunk? Yes, sir. Drunk with the nutmegs that it devoured under the nutmeg tree under which I found it. See, Fred Ned, see the monstrous effects of intemperance. By Jove, exclaimed the Canadian, because I have drunk gin for 2 months, you must needs reproach me. However, I examined the curious bird. Conseil was right. The bird, drunk with the juice, was quite powerless. It could not fly. It could hardly walk. This bird belonged to the most beautiful of the 8 species that are found in Papua and in the neighboring islands. It was the large emerald bird, the most rare kind. It measured 3 feet in length. Its head was comparatively small, its eyes placed near the opening of the beak and also small, but the shades of color were beautiful, having a yellow beak, brown feet and claws, nut-colored wings with purple tips, pale yellow at the back of the neck and head, and emerald color at the throat, chestnut on the breast and belly. 2 horned downy nets rose from below the tail that prolonged the long, light feathers of admirable finesse. And they completed the whole of this marvelous bird that the islanders have poetically named the Bird of the Sun. But if my wishes were satisfied by the Bird of Paradise, the Canadians were not yet. Happily, about 2 o'clock, Ned Land brought down a magnificent hog from the brood of those called Berry Utang. The animal was well received. The Canadian cleaned it properly after having taken 6 cutlets destined to furnish us with a grilled repast in the evening. Then the 2 friends roused a herd of kangaroos that fled and bounded along on their elastic paws. These animals were small. They were a species of those kangaroo rabbits that live habitually in the hollows of the trees and whose speed is extreme, but they are moderately fat and furnish at least estimable food. We were very satisfied with the results of the hunt. Happy Ned proposed to return to this enchanting island the next day, but he had reckoned without his host. At at 6 o'clock in the evening, we had regained the shore. Our boat was moored to the usual place, the Nautilus. Like a long rock, emerged from the wave 2 miles from the beach. Ned Land, without waiting, occupied himself about the important dinner business. He understood all about cooking well. The berry utang, or hog, grilled on the coals, soon scented the air with a delicious odor. Indeed, the dinner was excellent. 2 wood pigeons completed this extraordinary menu. The sago pasty, the breadfruit, some mangoes, 6 pineapples, and the liquor fermented from some coconuts overjoyed us. I even think that my worthy companion's ideas had not all the plainness desirable. "Suppose we do not return to the Nautilus this evening," said Conseil. "Suppose we never return," added Ned Land. Just then a stone fell at our feet and cut short the harpooner's proposition. Chapter 21. Captain Nemo's Thunderbolt. We looked at the edge of the forest without rising, my hand stopping in the action of putting it to my mouth, Ned Land's completing its office. "Stones do not fall from the sky," remarked Conseil, "or they would merit the name meteors." A second stone, carefully aimed, that made a savory pigeon's leg fall from Conseil's hand, gave still more weight to his observation. We all three arose, shouldered our weapons, and were ready to reply. "We're not alone," said Ned Land. "Very nearly." "To the boat," I said, hurrying to the sea. It was indeed necessary to beat a retreat, for about 20 islanders armed with bows and slings appeared on the skirts of a copse that masked the horizon to the right, hardly 100 steps from us. Our boat was moored about 60 feet from us. They approached us, not running, but making hostile demonstrations. Ned Land had not wished to leave his provisions, and in spite, he went tolerably fast. In 2 minutes, we were on the shore to load the boat with provisions. To push it out to sea and ship the oars was the work of an instant. We had not gone 2 cable lengths when 100 of them, howling and gesticulating, entered the water up to their waists. I watched to see if their apparition would attract some men from the Nautilus onto the platform. But no, the enormous machine, lying off, was absolutely deserted. 20 minutes later, we were on board. The panels were open. After making the boat fast, we entered into the interior of the Nautilus. I descended to the drawing room, from whence I heard some chords. Captain Nemo was there, bending over his organ, and plunged in a musical ecstasy. "Captain," he did not hear me. "Captain," I said, touching his hand. He shuddered, and turning around said, "Ah, it is you, Professor. Well, have you had a good hunt?"
Have you botanized successfully?
Yes, Captain, but
we have unfortunately brought a troop of bipeds whose vicinity troubles me.
So you are astonished, Professor, at having set foot on a strange land and finding strangers.
Where are there not any?
Besides, are they worse than others?
But, Captain, how many have you counted?
100 at least.
Monsieur Aronnax, replied Captain Nemo, placing his fingers on the organ stops. 100, 1,000, 10,000. The Nautilus will have nothing to fear from their attacks. The captain's fingers were then running over the keys of the instrument, and I remarked that he touched only the black keys, which gave his melodies an essentially Scotch character. Soon he had forgotten my presence and had plunged into a reverie that I did not disturb. I went up again onto the platform. Night had already fallen, for in this low latitude, the sun sets rapidly and without twilight. I could only see the island indistinctly, but the numerous fires lighted on the beach showed that they did not think of leaving it. I was alone for several hours, sometimes thinking of them, but without any dread of them. For the confidence of the captain was catching, sometimes forgetting them to admire the splendors of the night in the tropics. My remembrances went to France in the train of those zodiacal stars that would shine in some hour's time. The moon shone in the midst of the constellations of the zenith. The night slipped away without any mischance.